Okay, we're going to get started to our next topic on the agenda, which is audit confirmations. Dee Miranda-Gould, who's an associate chief auditor in the office of the chief auditor, will be leading that discussion. So I will go ahead and turn it over to Dee.
Thanks, Jennifer. Before we start our discussion of confirmations, I'd like to introduce Chris David to my left, assistant chief auditor in the office. Confirmation is an important source of the evidence auditors may obtain as part of an audit of a company's financial statements because generally it is presumed that evidence obtained from independent sources outside a company is more reliable than evidence solely from within the company. The auditing standard on confirmation defines confirmation as a direct communication from a third party in response to a request for information. That definition did not contemplate advances in technology, including electronic forms of communication that are available today, for example, electronic mail. Also, auditors may now obtain direct access, also referred to as direct online access, into the electronic records of an audit client's customer, bank, or other confirming party and check the existence and amount of the audit client's balance without the need for interaction with an employee of the customer, bank, or party. Direct access refers to an auditor obtaining a direct link into the electronic records on a read-only basis. To provide direct access to an auditor, a third party would provide a temporary password to the auditor to allow him or her to independently confirm the information held by that third party. An auditor using a client's password or sitting with a client to review electronic records would not constitute direct access the way we are contemplating it in this discussion. In addition to advances in technology, other changes have occurred. Some banks and other businesses have decided that they can no longer dedicate the resources required to handle responses to confirmations and thus have hired third parties to respond on their behalf. This leads me to our first question. Should the definition of confirmation allow for responses other than traditional mailed responses, such as oral confirmation, facsimile, email, responses processed through third-party service providers, and direct access to information held by a third party? Wayne Collins?
Yes. I guess I'll add to that. I mean, it's certainly in this environment, you know, at least Bank of America and I'm sure other financial institutions now are just not responding to confirmations. And that's their process, but they have established another process where an entity, particular entity that we use called Capital Confirmations, does have access to their records, and the issuer's information on their records. Therefore, we have established procedures going to those third parties to get access to it, and that certainly is, in our view, it's as strong as the normal paper confirmation process, and is the best alternative.
Thank you, Joe Carcello.
I would agree with Wayne just to second that. I'm somewhat familiar with the capital confirmation process, and I'm sure there are other competitors as well. And that seems to have a lot of merit, so I would encourage you to continue down that path. But as it relates to some of what you have up there, you have some other specific wording up there beyond what Wayne talked about. To me, the big issue as it relates to all confirmations, whether it's paper or anything else, is knowing who's responding to the confirmation. And again, I refer to some expert witness work I've done, and you do get colored by your experiences, we all do. And in that particular case, there was a problem, major problem with confirmations. And what was happening is the sales people were confirming rather than people in the accounting area. And so the confirmations weren't of a lot of value. So to me, that's a major issue to the auditor, is to get comfortable as to who's responding. As it relates to an oral confirmation, I think that can work as long as it's followed up with something written. Eventually, the problem with relying only on oral is that no written record of the confirmation response exists, could always be denied, could always claim misunderstanding. Phone conversations are prone to a lot of risk, as we all know from our personal life. And then I would suggest that the board think about, as it talks about confirmations, that they think about incentives to respond truthfully. In retailing, often you get vendor rebates, and so those can be receivables. And when you confirm them, you're confirming from a supplier. And so that, in that case, you're their customer. And so their incentives to not make you unhappy are very different than if you're confirming to somebody who buys from you. What are you going to do, not sell to them anymore? And so I think the board needs to think carefully about those incentives to respond truthfully, because I think it affects the quality of the audit evidence.
Thank you. Galen Hansen?
Our firm also uses an outside vendor that, and I think their name has been mentioned, so I won't mention it again the third time. And that seems to be working, but I'm a little bit distressed with the direction that the banking groups are going with this. I won't say anything more than that. As far as oral confirmations, I think an oral confirmation is essentially no confirmation is incompatible with AS3 as far as that documentation standard. And until you do follow up, as Joe just said, I don't think it constitutes a confirmation because of that misunderstanding, because of the things that can be misinterpreted. And so I would I'd kick oral confirmations out of this and basically say that it's no confirmation.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I'd just like to jump in and kind of ask a follow-up to Joe's point. I thought he made a very good point about incentives to respond truthfully. And Joe, just kind of wondering, in connection with your comment, is the suggestion that it should be a consideration by the auditor to consider if they're aware of any incentives, or I guess kind of in connection with your point, what are you thinking auditors should do? You know, it may be difficult to kind of understand that, but certainly I think it is a good point. So just wondering if you could expand on that to help us in our thinking.
Well, I think the language, I could be wrong, but my recollection of when I read this, you did talk about the auditor should consider the ability, the incentive, the willingness of parties to respond and respond truthfully. If my memory is right, you have language in here, so I'm not sure you need additional language. That's not obvious to me that you do. And I'm sure most of the firms would normally think that through carefully. And in those cases where they don't think it through carefully, that's an inspection or an enforcement issue.
Thank you. Arnold Schlender.
Thank you. I would offer that the IAASB recently had a new standard on confirmations. And a number of questions that are addressed here are also addressed in the standard that we produced. For example, what we mentioned about when there is a refusal to allow a confirmation, or it deals with oral confirmations, whether or not, and not without sufficient corroboration, and other issues, and I will not mention that time and again by question, just would point to the existence of that standard. Furthermore, we, in our meeting a couple of weeks ago, decided that it might be helpful if we issue a staff alert just to bring that standard to life, also in light of very recent developments that cast some doubt about the reliability of confirmation. So that would focus even more on how it's working in practice and thereby assist people in applying the standard. And if we can cooperate with the PCAOB in that respect, that would be great, because we, of course, are serving here a similar objective. Thanks.
So just let me clarify. You're suggesting we might consider a practice alert to discuss issues related to audit confirmations?
Well, that's we as IAASB decided to do. So staff will be working on that in cooperation with some experienced practitioners. But if in drafting that alert we could cooperate with the PCAOB, that of course would be quite helpful.
Okay, thank you. Gary Kerber.
Thank you. Two comments. One on oral. I mean, I don't know that oral confirmations never work, but I would certainly, if you were going to stack rank these things in priorities, you'd have it sort of minimalist, very low level of evidence, and sort of only on an emergency type basis, you know, last minute or something followed up. So I wouldn't put too much, you know, stock in it. But I'm actually looking at the last item in there, direct access to information held by a third party. And again, I accept technology can probably allow you to do that, but I would be nervous about having that be an allowable audit procedure, you know, for something important, because you don't necessarily know what you're looking at. If you're the auditor, and let's say you do have access into some vendor's records or some outsourcing records, and you think of, you know, let's say bank accounts. I mean, there might be, you know, one concentration account and 60 clearing accounts. So you're taking it upon yourself to decide, have I identified the right account or accounts, and have I read it correctly? I mean, these things, and it seems to me you're better off having someone respond on behalf of the institution itself, as opposed to you deciding I've interpreted somebody's ledger or trial balance correctly. It, again, a lot of these arrangements are very complicated, scattered through dozens of accounts and ledgers and stuff. I would be very careful about that. Again, I'm not saying it's an inappropriate procedure, but I have doubts about how good it really will be, you know, in the main for most of the time.
Galen Hansen. Oh, Hal Schroeder.
A few weeks ago, we were down here for the new members session, and I recall one of the sessions went into audit deficiencies, things that you all have found on inspections, and I was struck by the fact that audit confirmations, I think, was not, if it wasn't number one, it was number two on the hit list of things most often done wrong. Will this definition or some expanded definition help rectify that? Is this trying to address a specific problem? Could you give a little bit of color in terms of how this matches up with what you're all finding in the field?
The type of inspection findings related to confirmations, things like auditors not following up on exceptions on confirmation responses, or not following up when there's a non-response, there's no response at all. There's also been confirmation where the auditor has relied possibly too much for a particular assertion. So, for example, valuation of investments. Audit confirmations typically are better for existence assertion, maybe for some other things as well, but you know, to a lesser extent for valuation. And so in certain cases, that was a problem. I'm trying to remember some of the others. I think those are some of the biggest issues with confirmations that we've seen in inspections. So the definition itself doesn't address those kinds of exceptions. Possibly some other areas, like how to deal with exceptions, which isn't discussed in this in this SAG briefing paper, but that would address those kinds of issues. Any other? Oh. Joe Carcello.
Yeah, just a quick point to follow up on what Arnold said earlier. If our memory serves me correctly, I haven't looked at this recently, but if memory serves me correctly, a few years ago, the Auditing Standards Board issued a, it wasn't a standard, I forget what they call these things. It was like a practice alert, but I'm not sure they call it that, on confirmations. And I thought it was pretty good. I thought some of their specific suggestions in there were pretty good. So if you haven't looked at that, you might want to look at that.
Thank you. Yeah, it is a practice alert, and we definitely have looked at it. So, and we're definitely keeping it in mind as we're considering this topic. Jim Cox?
One of the other national committees I'm on is the American Bar Association's Corporate Law Committee, and I just thought I'd share an insight with you that something that this causes fits over the last year. We meet every quarter in half-day meetings, and it relates to this question about oral confirmations. And I share the same level of skepticism, if not outright cynicism about it, except for the following, is that there is a pretty well advanced technology now for taking an oral communication and reducing it to written format. And so you may want to think about that. There's oral and then there's oral. What causes us fits about that is the question about notice, which is a big deal for lawyers, okay? And when you get it, and if you get a message on your cell phone, is that notice at that point, or is it when you reduce it down, and what's it mean to be reduced down? And not everybody has the technology because it's fairly expensive. So it's just, you know, adding undoubtedly an insignificant lawyer footnote to this conversation. So.
Thank you.
May I have a follow-up? Oh, I was going to say, may I have a follow-up? But in that, Professor, in that conversation, did they get into discussion of whether it was legal to actually record it and how that varies from state to state?
It does. I mean, you know, our committee has a focus on a statute that's supposed to be a model for other states, and there are some variations, of course, across the states.
Ted White.
Just a quick comment. I don't really have any concerns over the alternative forms of confirmation except for oral. My take on that is that it just introduces too much potential problem and for very little benefit. And I would suggest just a bright line on oral confirmation at this point to prohibit it until such time that maybe there is some clear-cut advanced in technology in the future where you can accept it. But in just stepping back and thinking about it, it doesn't seem that if somebody's able to give an oral confirmation, it's that much harder to give a written one along with it. And I just don't see the benefit in it. And I agree with Joe's comments earlier, too, about the importance of the source probably more important, actually, than how it's transmitted. But the source is also something that's quite important there.
Bob Daisy.
And we would just like to reiterate the points that Arnold raised, that there are a lot of good materials, I think, in the IAASB standard that address this, and it's relatively recent and gone through due process. And some of the answers to the questions as we go through today, I think, are reasonably answered by their draft, and we would encourage consistency to the extent possible, including the definition. Secondly, with respect to the standard, it ought to be clear about some of these points, particularly oral. I don't think we believe that is a confirmation. It is some form of evidence, and you have to evaluate it in terms of evidence quality. And the other point with direct access, I think some of the language now about direct communication is a better issue because when you do that, there is some risk that who you're connecting to isn't the party you think you're connecting to, and therefore I think you'd have to employ a lot of procedures to ensure that you're actually getting it from that party to meet the requirements of what I think a confirmation would be. So one of the concerns about the proposed language might make too broadly open the direct access, because I do think there are a lot of issues related to verifying that other party. Thanks.
Thank you. Joe Casella.
One other thought that I mentioned, thought to mention earlier, proposal doesn't talk at all, unless I missed it, is the importance of evaluating the form that comes back. And here's what I mean by that. My understanding of what most firms do and what we did when I was in practice is the firm had a standard confirmation form that was sent out. And there was at least one prominent case that I'm aware of where what was sent back is what I would call customized letters from each client. It wasn't the firm's confirmation form. And what ended up being confirmed wasn't the balance, but the total revenue transactions during the year. And obviously what needed to have been confirmed was the receivables balance at the end of the year. And again, maybe, you know, in some sense you think, you know, do you even need to say things like this in a standard, because most auditors are going to be, I would hope, very sensitive to that. But you may want to at least consider the issue of what is the implication if the auditor sends out a confirmation form and gets back something that's very different, how he or she should respond to that.
Thank you. Warren Malkus.
Just from a preparer's point of view, I would take exception, or I do take exception, I guess, to the use of oral confirmations, because I think it's a less quality standard to follow, and I think that it makes it more inefficient for both the external auditor and also for the preparer. Other point here on direct access, I think this would go a long ways in increasing the response rate and the quality of confirmations if there you do have give direct access to the auditors, to customers, to banks, to other financial institutions with whom you might have debt with. But to Gary's point, I think there's some training that needs to take place so that there is the proper use of that direct access. Otherwise, it will add to the inefficiency of an audit and also to that of for the preparer.
Thank you. Okay, Galen Hansen. We get that right? Okay.
Do. I just wanted to follow up on Joe, what you're talking about, the non-standard replies. I don't really have too much of an issue with that, because it's third-party evidence that is coming back. As long as you can reconcile that to the receivable balance, in some ways, I think that's another way of getting to the same thing. I would just consider that a reply with comments that you've reconciled, and not necessarily an exception or something that you cannot rely on. But I do agree that something should be considered perhaps in standard when you do get something back that's completely different than what you asked for.
Thank you. Let's move to our next discussion topic. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
This was the challenging part. We actually both had our 10
seconds. How? Sure.
My initial thought was oral confirmations, like most people, it's very problematic. But then I thought back to, situations where you're dealing with, and I had one like this where it was military shipments. You could get oral confirmation, but you could not get written confirmations. I don't know if there's anyone who's got, certain security clearances that could address that issue, but I think there are certain circumstances where you're not going to get anything in writing. And would this, by excluding it, preclude that? So if there was a way to work that into the language where it's permissible in certain circumstances, and maybe that's one illustration of it.
Thank you. Wayne Collins?
I just wanted to supplement what Galen had mentioned, which played off Joe's comment. If you get confirmation back, that's different from what you sent out in terms of what information you got back. I just think the standard could be written that, to assess whether the objectives of your confirmation request were fulfilled by what you got back. If they were not, then you need to do some more work.
Thank you. Any other? Okay. Now let's move to our next discussion topic, the requirement for an auditor to confirm accounts. The current auditing standard includes the presumption that the auditor will request the confirmation of accounts receivable during an audit. The standard further provides that an auditor should consider requesting confirmation of the terms of unusual agreements or transactions, such as bill and hold sales, in addition to the amounts. Other standard setters have differing views on whether auditors should be required to request confirmation of accounts receivable and other items. For example, ISA 505 does not require confirmation of any specific accounts, terms, or transactions. While the Auditing Standards Board of the AICPA has indicated that inclusion of the presumptive requirement to confirm accounts receivable is appropriate. That leads me to my next question. Should the board expand the presumptively mandatory requirement to request confirmation of accounts receivable in AU Section 330 to include confirmation of terms of unusual agreements or transactions and complex or unusual revenue transactions? Tom Taft?
My view on this is if you were to expand the mandatory requirement, you would then invariably need to define what the scope of unusual transactions were. And even under the best circumstances, you'd never be able to contemplate every kind of unusual transaction. Even if you were able to define all of those today, there's going to be new ones tomorrow. I think you've got to leave this to the judgment of the auditor to determine when is it appropriate and necessary to use a confirmation as a means of getting appropriate audit evidence.
Doug Anderson.
Yeah, I've always felt that confirmations are one of many sources of audit evidence. You can get audit evidence through all sorts of different means. And making the presumption that confirmations is one of the very best in every risk scenario is not necessarily true. So I've never been in favor of the presumptively mandatory requirement because it may have no correlation with the risk of what you're looking at. I think a much better guidance approach would be to talk about the value of confirmations, the weaknesses, the pros and cons of what scenarios it works well in and what scenarios it doesn't, but not to have any presumptive mandatory requirement regarding confirmations of receivables or anything else, and leave it up to the judgment of the auditor to decide based on the risk of the engagement, the risk of the specific area, whether confirmations is a good part of the audit evidence they have to gather, or whether there's other types of audit evidence that might be better or more efficient.
Hal Schroeder.
We've actually kicked this one around internally from an investment standpoint. As we were talking about fair value, last week we actually had a conference call with the FASB on this. One of the ideas that was kicked around was a central clearinghouse of some sort where you could actually confirm credit default swaps or other bilateral transactions where there are really only two parties involved. And as I read this, I thought this is an ideal place to expand confirmations. And I agree, Doug, with your comment. There's some places where it just doesn't make sense. There's no risk there. But there are other places where a confirmation, like a credit default swap, would be a tremendous value. A, does the transaction exist? B, do we have the same terms? And C, I would go as far as saying, if it's a zero-sum game, I lose $10 million, you make $10 million, we ought to confirm that that's actually, at least within ballpark, that we're dealing with the same numbers, so that they are the mirror image of us. I know that may be way beyond the scope of this, but I think the board actually ought to very seriously consider the need for this in light of all these types of transactions and the troubles that we've had in the last year or two.
Thank you. Galen Hansen.
I would agree a lot of this is based on judgment. And as you point out, Harold, I mean, there might be some situations where it might be very straightforward to do the confirmation. On the other hand, you have an agreement. Sometimes I wonder whether, why don't we just attach the agreement to the confirmation, mail it to the client or the confirming party and say, do you agree with this? And you've got a written agreement signed by both parties in the file, so how much are you going to get into this definition of what is unusual and the terms and so forth? And I think you have to go back to judgment, so I don't know that you can standardize that.
Thank you. Paul Sobel.
I think I'm just going to add on pretty much to what's been said before. One other thing to consider here, and I like Doug's suggestion about providing guidance on when confirmations are useful versus less so, and also Galen's last suggestion. If you think about it, an accounts receivable balance is quite simple to confirm. You can have almost a clerical person, I suspect this happens frequently, somebody in the clerical capacity looks up in the system at a point in time, what was the balance? Yes, that's right. Confirms back. When you get into more complicated arrangements, I'd be concerned that, again, absent attaching the contract, you may get confirmation that, yes, those terms exist. There may be other terms that have some very significant impact on the accounting that, for whatever reason, you failed to put in the confirmation and then would not be confirmed as such. So, again, I think there is value to the confirmation, but I don't think it should be required because you're not always certain who is responding to that. Again, if a clerical person is responding on a very complex, again, even credit default swap, do they understand the underlying economics and the accounting implications of that credit default swap, or are they just going to go tick, 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 yes, I found those in a contract, good enough?
Thank you. J. Joe Corsello.
Let me respond to what Doug said earlier, because I think you have language in the standard now that allows for that in terms of not sending confirmations. If you look at footnote 7 on page 4, starting with the second paragraph, the auditor can overcome the presumption to request confirmation if accounts receivable are immaterial, or the auditor's combined assessed level of inherent and control risk is low, and the assessed level in conjunction with other evidence is sufficient to reduce audit risk to an acceptably low level. So I think the standard that exists already contemplates not needing to send confirmations. I also think it would be dicey to have a PCAOB standard that would at least be viewed in the eyes of outsiders as a lower level of performance than an ASB standard. And as long as the ASB requires confirmation, I think it puts the PCAOB in a tough position. I also would agree with, Harold said earlier, considering expanding the use of confirmations. I don't know if I would require it. Requiring it's always a bit dicey, but encouraging, particularly as it relates to confirming terms of material revenue transactions near year end, the amount, the order date, the receipt date, to get at cutoff. Cutoff's a big issue with revenue. And right of return provisions, particularly oral, which are very problematic, as we've seen in many frauds. Again, the focus that I'm coming from here is, I think if you talk to most investors, they would say what they care about is fraud, errors that result in material restatements, and clean opinions before a company shortly thereafter goes belly up. We'll talk about going concern this afternoon. And a lot of these frauds, I don't think a typical management wakes up early in the year, say, today's a good day to start a fraud. It happens toward the end of the year when it's obvious they're not going to hit the targets that the analysts have set, and some management's give in to pressure. And we know that in terms of fraud, revenue recognition is the override, by far the most common means of committing fraud. So if you look at transactions close to year end that are involve material revenue transactions and at least consider confirming them, that would probably be a prudent course of action in many cases.
Thanks, Joe, and you're correct. I mean, the standard right now does have the presumption for accounts receivable, and it has the should consider language about unusual and complex transactions. Gary Kapurk.
This is going to probably be building somewhat on some of the other comments about confirming unusual transactions and arrangements and stuff like that. I mean, the way I think it would work in most big companies, I mean, clerical people are going to give the dollars and cents, but they're probably not going to be actually having the contract. I mean, that's going to probably say the legal department or the business development department or the controller's department. So the clerks are not going to be able to confirm these things. I mean, they pay bills as they come in, you know, or they collect cash as it comes in, as the case may be. But you're going to be dealing with an entirely different level of management if you want to start getting into confirming, you know, the salient terms of deals. And if all of a sudden, if an audit requirement came out where the middle management core, the general counsel's core of the country, is all of a sudden got an extra million confirmations coming out a year, you're not... That's a workload issue. It's going to be challenged, I would think, as far as necessity. I think judgment is the right way to do it. I mean, certainly confirming complex and strange arrangements has its place in auditing, but I think to be required, I think, is going one step beyond where it needs to be.
Thank you. Doug Anderson.
And just to follow up on my conversation and kind of respond to Joe's thoughts, in all consideration of what's in a footnote 7, I think it's upside down when the reliance on judgment and focus on risk is buried in footnote 7 and the narrow prescriptive standard is put up in the front. I think the right order of it is focus the auditor on risk, focus the auditor on persuasiveness of audit evidence, and explain how confirmations work. If we want to put in footnote 7 that receivables is a great place to confirm, go ahead. But I would not put in footnote 7, use your judgment, and then put in the primary standard, we're assuming you're going to confirm receivables. That seems upside down. And if the ASB and the AICPA has a different standard, that's fine. I still think the PCAOB should take the best approach and convince the ASB to change their minds.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, let's move to the next question in this area. Should there be a requirement that the auditor should consider requesting confirmation of other items? If so, which items should be included in this requirement? Galen? Hansen?
I'll jump in here. I think whenever you can focus in on a KPI, a key performance indicator, that involves non-financial measures. And in my part of the world, that might be tons in the mining industry or barrels produced. I like to see those things confirmed, and then it ties back into the financial records. So I don't know that that's part of the standard, but I think it's just sort of common sense, and a lot of times you can get to a quicker answer and a more logical and practical answer if you're confirming some of those sorts of metrics.
So, Galen, would you be saying a should consider?
Yes.
Type of requirements appropriate?
Absolutely. Maybe it's patient days. It could be any number of things, and they would be all over the board depending on what industry you're dealing with, but more of an understanding of the business and industry type of approach.
Thank you. Tom Taft?
I wouldn't object to this requirement. However, I would think that in most situations today, auditors are already considering using confirmations as part of the audit process, and thus would question whether it even needs to be an explicit requirement.
Thank you. Hal Schroeder?
This is more of a question. You use the term here, investments. Why would you not be using the more of the financial instruments terminology from the accounting standards?
It's a good question. I mean, we were thinking broadly. Investments was a term we picked, but we could say financial instruments. There's no reason why it couldn't be that. Wayne Collins?
Yeah, I think rather than getting into the particulars of which accounts or areas should be considered specifically, I think the auditor needs to address the assertions that are that he's interested in, he or she is interested in, and what is the persuasive means of obtaining evidence to corroborate the assertions. And if confirmation is the persuasive evidence, then that's what the auditor should use. And certainly areas that are quite often confirmed on audits are certainly cash, marketable securities, accounts payable. I think maybe firms have gotten away from that, but since there's such an acceleration of the filing deadlines to rely on subsequent disbursements to verify accounts payable, perhaps the actual confirmation is a quicker way of getting to the answer, in addition to assessing the quality of the internal control system.
Thank you. Bob Deasy?
Yeah, I'd just like to offer that I think in our view there shouldn't be absolute requirements, even should considers, because of the variability that we've all talked about here today. One of the discussion points we had too is that if confirmation is perceived to be of a particular value, that perhaps it ought to be the use of confirmations ought to be discussed in your auditor's response to risk of material misstatement and focus this standard on what the confirmation process is if you decide to use confirmation.
Thank you. Sam Renzilla?
I agree with Bob. A requirement to should consider basically drives the auditor to document all the things it thought about and didn't do. And it seems to me what we ought to be focused on is the risk assessment and what you did do, and documenting your risk, and how you responded to that risk. So I would not be in favor of a requirement to should consider, because it just, again, leads to documentation around what you decided you didn't need to do.
Thank you. Any other comments? Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. I think I'd like the requirement in that I think we've had some recent events where the cash that the company had said existed did not exist, or the investments the company said they had did not exist. So I think there's some expectation out there that one efficient way to get some audit evidence about the existence of those cash balances and investments is through a confirmation. So I think there is some expectation by some investors that confirmations are being sent out in those areas. So I think I would support the requirement.
Thank you. Any other comments?